The third week of our introductory course. And today I'm going to at some point talk about how to include emotions, our emotional life, as part of mindfulness practice. Our emotions are an important part of our lives, and for some people they're more important than others, and some people less important. Some people have manifestos that they were ready to publish broadly about their beliefs about emotions and what emotions mean and what we're supposed to do about them. And so in a sense, I'm going to tell you something else to do about them today, and how to include them as part of mindfulness practice, which perhaps for some of you will be a very different approach to how to relate to emotions than perhaps the way you usually are relating to them. The ultimate aim of Buddhist practice is to become free or liberated. And what that means in Buddhist spiritual life is a little bit of subject in its own right. But the simplest definition of what this freedom means, it's freedom from clinging, freedom from any kind of clinging or resistance or fear or hatred, but any kind of movement of the mind for or against anything is understood in Buddhism to be a form of bondage. If you are compelled or driven by your emotions or your reactions, your desires, by your clinging, then you're not free. To have emotions, to have desires, is just human thing to have happen. But to be driven by them, to be forced to act on them, to act habitually without any kind of consideration, is, in Buddhist language, use very strong language to say a person is in bondage. And liberation is to be freed from that bondage, freed from any kind of compulsion or any kind of drivenness, any kind of attachment we might have to acting or behaving or speaking or thinking or feeling or emoting in any kind of fixed way. The freedom in Buddhism is a freedom from compulsion. And one of the aims of this is to have us so we're no longer in conflict with ourselves, and in a particular kind of Buddhist way of understanding this, no longer in conflict with the world around us, but certainly no longer to be at war and conflict with ourselves. And for people, people often maybe understand two very general ways of ending conflict with oneself. One is to give free rein to whatever your desires are, whatever your wants are, whatever your aversions might be, just no longer be inhibited. You know, I was shy for a long time about, you know, expressing my desires, and now I'm not shy anymore. I'm just free to kind of express my desires and act on them. And kind of a parody of this kind of approach would be the American ideal or dream of, you know, shop till you drop. You know, free to shop, free to kind of consume as much as you want. And if you have that kind of freedom just to act on every whim and every desire, there's a kind of ease that can come, kind of happiness that can come, where you're no longer in conflict with your desires. But it's not very realistic to expect that you can follow through on every desire that you possibly can think of, or every resistance or aversion you have about how things are. And sooner or later, you'll run into reality, which is going to cause problems. So you can't have that, or you can't follow through on that, or... So the freedom of Buddhism is not the freedom to act in any way you want, but is a freedom from having to act compulsively. The freedom that can be, we find our sense of independence, in this independent presence, in this independent sense of well-being, that's independent of whether a desire is fulfilled or not fulfilled, whether a fear is present or not present. Can you be, the idea in Buddhism is to be fearless means not necessarily to be without fear, but to not be influenced by that fear, to be able to abide within yourself independent of the fear that might bubble up. And what this requires in part, as you follow a Buddhist path, is a shift of center, shift of identity. A shift of where we put our priorities, or where we put our kind of, where we hang our hat. If we put our values, our priority, our center in our desires, then we're likely to be carried along by the whims of our desires. If we put our center of gravity in our fear, then we're liable to be carried away by our fears or influenced by them. But if we can shift our identity slightly and have our identity reside, be someplace independent of fear, of desire, of thoughts, of feelings, of body sensations, then we can allow those things to be there without being that, without those kind of driving us or forcing us to be compelled to act in a certain way. So in relationship to emotions, in Buddhism, the idea is in no way are you supposed to be an unemotional person. The meditation practice is supposed to help you to free up your emotional life, but then to help you have uncomplicated emotions. What I like to say is that meditation practice, sitting in meditation, is, or hopefully should be, one of the safest places you'll ever encounter where it's fine to emote any way that is happening. To let any emotion bubble up within you is appropriate and fine. There's no need to censor or inhibit or judge or evaluate the presence of any emotion that's bubbling up. That in this meditation posture is kind of a very special place where we give ourselves unconditioned permission to let our emotions flow through us as they wish. And at the same time, what this means is we've learned how also it's at the same time not to be caught by them, hooked by them, not to see the world through the filter of those emotions, not to be influenced by those emotions so that we run away or we grasp or we hate or we get involved in all kinds of fantasies and thoughts and judgments about people and ourselves. So can you allow anger to rise within you freely, without inhibition, if that's what wants to come up, but without any kind of criticism of that anger, or without any tendency to see the world through the filter of that anger? And many of us are familiar, you know, that we often can see the world through the filter of the emotions we have. And sometimes if we're filled with anger, irritation, or annoyance, then the world around us is a very annoying place. And if we believe our emotions, emotional glasses we're wearing, we don't think it's us that's causing the irritation in the world. We think that's the world out there, those people out there, which are the problem. On a different day, we feel filled with calm or delight or peace or love, and we wear very different kind of glasses for how we see the world. To be free in Buddhism is to be free to let the emotions move through us, but have discovered a capacity of attention, of awareness, which is not influenced by the emotions that are there. So freedom means both getting out of the way of what's moving within us so we can move freely. At the same time, having our center of gravity, our center of identity, not tied up in those things. So there's a kind of independent presence that can see things clearly in spite of whatever's moving through us. So an important part of mindfulness practice then is the investigation of our emotions, learning how to be present for emotions, learning to develop a capacity of independent presence, independent attention in the midst of our emotional life. And you can only develop that kind of independent presence and independent seeing of emotions if you're willing to look at them, if you're willing to include them as part of the meditation practice. When I first started doing meditation practice, I had no idea that the emotions had anything to do with meditation at all. And I basically just ignored them. And I found that it was very painful to do that because certain emotions like anger, when they were ignored and not paid attention to, then would have this tremendous influence on me in my life. I would see the world around me through a filter of anger. I would be in conflict with myself, I'd be angry at myself, frustrated, and it would get in the way of the meditation practice. But I wasn't paying attention to it. I wasn't noticing that I was angry. So part of meditation practice is a willingness to recognize and acknowledge emotions when they come up so that we can develop an independent presence, independent freedom in the midst of those emotions while they're happening. So hopefully that was clear enough. If it wasn't, then I apologize. So let's start with a short sitting. And if for some reason my voice is not carrying to the back of the room, then raise your hands and at any point, and I will adjust. So sit upright in an alert but relaxed manner. Gently close your eyes. And then straight out, as we begin here, what is the emotion or mood, mental state, which is most present for you? What's happening emotionally for you as you sit here? Are you calm or tense, impatient, relaxed, happy, sad, irritated, contented, perplexed? There's always some mood or emotional state that's present, though it might be very subtle. And then as you become aware of your emotional state, see if you can find out what is your relationship to that being there. What's your attitude towards this emotion or to your emotions in general? Could you imagine yourself, or could you actually manage to simplify your relationship to the emotional state that you have? Somehow give it permission to be as it is. Allowing yourself to be as you are while you stay feeling or staying aware of what's happening for you. And what happens to your mood or your emotional state as you acknowledge it and recognize it? And then letting go of that to begin the regular meditation period. Take a few long, slow, deep breaths. As you exhale, letting go of your thoughts and concerns. And then letting your breathing return to normal. And it can be helpful at the beginning of a session of meditation to scan through your body to see if there's any muscles that can be softened or relaxed. Sometimes the forehead can be softened, the eyes, corner of the eyes. Sometimes there can be a loosening of the jaw, a relaxing of the shoulders. And it can be very helpful to soften your belly. Let your belly hang forward. Perhaps so your breathing drops deeper into your torso. And then becoming aware of how your body experiences the breathing. The sensations within your body that let you know that now you're breathing. Sensations of movement, pressure, relaxation, tingling, vibration, warmth, coolness. And in practicing mindfulness of the breathing, there are two aspects. One is connecting yourself to the breathing. Discovering what the breath feels like, discovering where you feel it in your body. Letting the attention settle or move or connect to your breathing. And the second aspect is sustaining the attention over time, letting there be a steadiness of attention with the breath. If the mind wanders off in thought, then gently let go of the thought, relax the thinking mind, and begin again with your breathing. Connect with the breathing, and then make some effort to sustain the attention with one breath after the other, kind of getting into the rhythm of the breath, of the breathing. Sometimes it can help to have the attitude that you're resting in the breathing or relaxing into the breathing, one breath after the other. And then sometimes, instead of relaxing into the breathing, it can be helpful to establish a kind of a firm dedication with the breath, a firmness to staying with one breath after the other. Sometimes being very firm and dedicated with the breathing, holding on to it in a sense, not letting the mind waver from the breath. Sometimes that'll allow all the tendencies to be distracted or wander off into thought, to relax, to let go, to give up. And now for the last few minutes of the sitting, stop paying attention to the breathing and instead notice once again what is the basic emotion or mood, mental state that is present for you. If you can recognize some mood or mental state, emotion, clearly name it to yourself a few times. Sometimes naming something, emotion, helps us not be entangled with it. Noticing what your emotional state is, see if you can feel your way into it. What is the felt sense within your body or your mind or your head, your heart? What is the felt sense of the mood or mental state that's present for you? And then what is your attitude? What is your relationship to the presence of whatever emotion is present, however subtle it might be? And then take a couple of deep breaths. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes. So in practicing mindfulness, there are two aspects of the present moment which are very interesting to be aware of. Since mindfulness practice is an awareness practice, paying attention to what's going on in the present, it's helpful to have some guidelines of what it is that we're paying attention to. And very generally, you can say there's two areas we're paying attention to. One is in a sense, what's actually happening. And the second is, what is our relationship to what's happening? So we could have the car alarm going off, as we did a few moments ago, and that's what's happening. And then there could be all these relationship we have to that. It could be, oh, I want fear. Is that my car? Or irritation or anger, you know, those cars, you know, how could people, you know, or all kinds of, you know, or all kinds of relationships we might have to what's happening. We're following the breath in meditation, and the breath is what it is, and then we relate to it in some way. Oh, that was a good breath, that was a bad breath. Or we're distracted in our meditation, or we're very concentrated in our meditation. Then what's your relationship to that? Oh, I really hate it when I'm distracted. Oh, I must be God's gift to Buddhism. I'm so concentrated. And we enter into a relationship all the time with what's going on. And so part of what we do pay attention to in mindfulness practice is, what is that relationship you have with what's going on? So with an emotion, for example, an emotion can arise. And then what's your relationship to the presence of that emotion? And most of us don't ask that question. Most of us go along with our emotions, and, you know. But what's the relationship we have to it? Do we believe it? Do we condemn it? Do we praise it? Do we hold on to it? Do we cling to it? What's the relationship we have? Do we assign meaning to its presence? Oh, this is here, that means that. And we get caught up in a mental world of meaning. And that in turn feeds back, creating more emotions. I had a little lesson on this last night. I went to bed around 11 o'clock, and around midnight I noticed that I wasn't falling asleep. And I thought, well, gee, this is not so good. I thought, you know, I should probably get some good rest and be rested for the day, for tomorrow, for today. And then, oh, if I'm not rested, then I'll be really sleepy for the things I have to do. And then I won't be able to do them well, and then people will be angry with me, or they won't like me, or, you know, I'll just be a mess, and it's not good. And then I started feeling a little bit sad, or a little bit upset, or a little bit irritated, because of what I thought was going to happen the next day. But then I noticed all this, and then I asked myself, what am I actually feeling right now? Independent of the meaning I'm assigning to this. Well, I felt actually quite happy and great. I had no problems. I was comfortable. You know, it was basically very peaceful and nice to be there. But what was happening was that I was overlooking the fact that I was quite peaceful and happy to be there, and even though I was awake and a little bit energized. But these thoughts were creeping in. This relationship to that, to what was happening, crept in, and was beginning to get the upper hand. So that if I hadn't paid attention, I could have easily spiraled into being, you know, quite upset and depressed and angry and then energized because of that, and even harder to fall asleep. But I knew to pay attention to my relationship here. Oh, my relationship to not falling asleep. Oh, and I saw, oh, this is actually causing more suffering than is actually present here in the present moment, the anticipation of what this might mean in the future. And in fact, it didn't mean what I thought it might mean. I was quite, for the most part today, quite energized and awake, and until I took a nap at 4 o'clock. But until that point, I was fine, and I took a 10-minute nap, and so what is the relationship you have to your emotions as they arise? Or to anything? So what was it like for some of you to do that meditation? What was it like to check in at the beginning about your emotional state, to be with your breathing for the middle section, and then the end to go back to your emotion? What did you notice?
For me, I was feeling a lot of tenseness, and the effort is always to get rid of that tenseness. So I thought about, is it to get rid of it, just notice it, still feel it, it's there. But generally feeling pleased to be here and noticing the tenseness, that's about it.
Uh-huh. And so the question for you is whether to try to continue getting rid of the tension or just let it be there.
Yeah, kind of.
Mm-hmm. It's a good question. Someone else? Yes?
I noticed I was mentally relaxed, but physically.
Yes? Was that okay?
Yeah.
And what did you feel instead?
I couldn't identify her.
Yes?
When I start feeling emotions, it's either anger or sadness, and I start getting a pain in my back. And when the emotions come up, the pain starts, and then I can ignore the emotion and start focusing on the pain and thinking that I have to stop doing this. It hurts too much.
I see.
There's a direct relationship between them.
You're very lucky to see that relationship, because some people don't see it. And they have all kinds of physical pain, and they don't really know what the source is. And sometimes it's emotional. And one of the things we do then in mindfulness practice is to not shift our posture and relieve the pain. But if you really think that pain is from an emotional base, is then bring your attention very careful to the physicality of that emotion. Actually feel very carefully what's going on there in your body at that place. And it might open up in a very interesting way if you do that. You're intellectualizing?
I was intellectualizing my feelings rather than feeling my feelings.
Ah. So intellectualizing means thinking about them or analyzing them? Or
analyzing, maybe I feel sad now, maybe I feel angry or whatever. Uh-huh. I feel genuine.
Okay. And could you shift then to feeling instead of intellectualizing? Well, you might see if your tendency is to intellectualize about your feelings, is to try shifting to feeling them instead, and hang out with them as if you're just feeling them, as if they have permission to be there, and see how they change if you're feeling your way into them, rather than thinking your way into them. Yeah. So then you were confused.
Yeah.
That's a feeling. So the spirit or the approach of mindfulness is that of being discoverers, kind of being investigators of our experience, kind of noticing what's going on here. So many people associate meditation with becoming calm or centered. Or there's a lot of things people associate meditation as being the point of meditation. And what I suggest to you that the transformative power of mindfulness meditation does not come from some special kind of feeling you're going to have, calm or joy or whatever, but rather it comes from the noticing what's actually happening in your experience right now. Right now, what is your experience? Right now, what is your experience? What's this? What's going on here? And it's a constant kind of very gentle, very peaceful, asking yourself or looking, what's happening now? What's happening now? Will bring you a lot greater peace than leaning into or trying to into becoming calm or relaxed or energized or whatever the intention is that's different than simply noticing what's happening now. In Buddhism, the ultimate liberation that Buddhism teaches comes from the simple practice of keep noticing what's happening now, what's happening now. And one of the things to notice is the relationship you have to what's happening now, so that your relationship slowly can become simpler and simpler, or less and less complicated, or less entangled. So you can have a feeling, an emotion for example, and you're in no way influenced or entangled by that emotion. Yeah.
So I have a question. So I'm having an emotion, and in some sense,
you try, in a sense, you're being more with the observer, but you're letting the observer be very intimate with experience. So you don't want to be, you don't want to be aloof or detached from the experience, but you also don't want to be entangled with it. No, absolutely not. And but one of the you're not supposed to muzzle it or try to inhibit it or stop it or get anything go away or hold on to it. Or, however, what happens with certain class of emotions only exists through time because we feed them and fuel them. So anger, for example, the only if we stay anger through time, and if we get really a big burst of anger, then there's a kind of suddenly all this energy in the system for a while, and it continues a little bit through time because it's, as it dissipates. But the all emotions dissipate through time, unless we reignite them or refuel them. And so, like for resentment is anger, which is kind of frozen anger that's constantly being refueled by clinging and holding or resistance to something. So once we, so a certain class of emotions which only exist by our continual refueling of them, getting entangled with them and feeding them and getting engaged with them, will tend to dissipate when we have this non-evaluative awareness, disentangled awareness of the experience. There's another class of them, and those kind of emotions are sometimes called in Buddhism afflictive emotions. Afflictive because they're painful. There's another class of emotions in Buddhism, in Buddhist psychology, which arise, in a sense, more from the kind of a natural being of who we are. Things like love and joy and delight, when they're in no way mixed up with lust or desire or wanting or aversion, then they kind of bubble up from the core of who we are, in a sense. And those emotions don't get fueled by our recognizing and being connected to them, but actually get stronger the more we're mindful of them. It's kind of like this, that the way Buddhist psychology teaches is that the afflictive emotions, those which cause us suffering, thrive in darkness, in unawareness, not in ignorance, not paying attention to them. But they fade away as we bring mindfulness to them. The beneficial, emotions thrive in the light of awareness and get starved in the darkness of unawareness. So it's kind of like if you have a greenhouse and you put kind of a big curtain over the greenhouse so no light comes in, and what grows then, I guess, I suppose, just the mold and the algae and stuff, and these wonderful roses you're trying to grow in the greenhouse, they kind of wither up. But then if you pull the curtain away from the greenhouse and the sunlight comes in, then the mold and the algae kind of shrivels up and disappears, and the roses blossom. So there are certain class of emotions which get fueled by our continual involvement with them, at the same time we're not paying careful attention to them. So anger, irritation, hate, greed, lust, ambition, confusion, ignorance, all get kind of fed both by ignorance, by not paying careful attention to them, but also when we do pay attention to them, they get fed by our indulging in them or feeding or getting tangled with them. And part of what we're trying to do in mindfulness practice is to see things directly as they are, bring that light of awareness to things without continuing to refuel them. And then certain things then will dissipate. And certain things will come into birth then. So I'm continually amazed, even after all these years, that just sitting quietly and peacefully, very deep feelings of love and delight and joy can kind of just bubble up for no reason at all. Whereas most of us, for most of our emotional lives, I venture to say most of us, I don't know how it is for everyone, but has a lot to do with what's actually happening to us. There's a reason for why we feel a certain way. We win the lottery, and we feel pretty happy. We get a raise, we feel happy. We meet some wonderful person, we feel happy. There's a reason for it. Or we get fired, or all kinds of terrible things happen, and because of those things, we feel depressed and sad. There's a reason for why we feel certain things. There's a whole other class of emotions and feelings that don't have to have a reason, but get born when we kind of get out of the way. It's almost as if inside, in our core, there's all these great feelings that are ready to kind of bubble up if the surface gets cleared of our preoccupation with the reasons. With what, you know, if we stop being entangled by relating to things always. Because most of what our mind does is always relating to something. We're relating to something. I like this, I don't like this. I want this, I don't want that. And if we stop having a mind which is always relating to things, then the mind becomes freed up for something new to happen. And that new thing that can happen is some deep feelings, deep sense of presence or joy or happiness or peace, ultimate liberation, can kind of bubble up from the core of who we are, in a sense. Does that make some sense, what I'm saying? When I teach mindfulness to kids, I hold a bell like this, and I hold it tight, I grasp it, because I'm relating to it, and I want it, I want this bell, I really want it really desperately, and this has to be mine, I'm not going to give it to you. And as long as I hold it that way, you know, it doesn't make a nice sound. But then if I release my holding of it and no longer relating to it, like grasping it and wanting it and, you know, doing all this, you know, if I'm no longer about it, just kind of let it be there in its open hand and relaxed way, then it makes a nice sound. So the mindfulness practice is a practice of noticing what's going on. In the process of doing that, learning how to no longer be entangled with the way things actually are in our life. Am I making some sense tonight? Yeah? Do you have other comments? Yes?
Could you say something about the feeling quality of pleasant and unpleasant in relation to emotion?
So Allison wants to say something about the feeling tone. In Buddhist psychology, it's taught that every experience we have has either a pleasant quality, unpleasant quality to it, or both pleasant or neither, kind of neutral, sometimes said. And what's very, very interesting is that we often relate to experiences by whether they're pleasant or unpleasant. So as we pay attention to emotions and feelings and mental states, you notice how there's a kind of sometimes an amoeba-like kind of reaction. We go towards the grasp things that are pleasant, and we pull away from or push away things which are unpleasant. And if you can see this operating, you can see how a pleasant experience arises and a leaning towards it, an unpleasant experience arises and a cringing or pulling back. If you can actually see that happening, then that very seeing of it helps establish ourselves independent of that process. So there's a marvelous thing about mindfulness is that the very seeing of what's happening, the process of seeing or recognizing or being aware of, is in a sense stepping outside of the game. Stepping outside of that particular thing that we're watching so that we're in a sense independent or no longer entangled with it. That makes sense? Yeah, you follow that? So, other concerns or questions? Please, anything at all that seems relevant here before I go on. Objections? Yeah. How does love?
As I understand Buddhism, it involves, as you say, not grasping.
Well, I'm just kind of, I don't feel like I'm anywhere qualified to talk about this yet. In about 12 years, maybe. You know, my son is 4 now. But what I've seemed to notice in myself is that the love of children, or my child, I can relate to my child through attachment, through clinging. So the word attachment in English is a little bit problematic because we have good associations for attachment. Whenever Buddhists use the word attachment, it's negative connotations. And so then we kind of miss each other because we're kind of talking about slightly different things. But there's ways in which I suffer because I'm attached or cling to that relationship, or how I want him to be, or how I want him to be, or how I want the relationship to be, or how I want him to grow up, or, you know, all kinds of things. I can suffer a lot. I can love him a lot, and that love can give energy to that clinging, that I want things to be a certain way. And a lot of parents, you know, have to deal with their clinging around their children. At the same time, I recognize that there's a kind of what I call a bonding that happens with my child, which I don't want to call attachment or clinging, but it seems to be almost a kind of biological sense of responsibility for that person. That seems to have almost a life of its own. So, for example, once I was in Palo Alto when he was maybe a year and a half or so, and so he was walking around a little bit, and we were on the sidewalk, and I stopped to talk to someone, and suddenly I noticed that he wasn't... I had my back to the street. And suddenly I noticed that he wasn't next to me. And afterwards, what was really remarkable to me was the fact that as soon as I noticed that he wasn't there, it was almost like instinct. Like I wasn't... There was no thought that seemingly involved. I knew where the street was. And I just pivoted around to make sure that he wasn't walking into the street. In fact, he wasn't that direction, but, you know, so I stopped him. And I felt it was kind of like a biological connection to that child that was kind of, you know, might be kind of an attachment to that child, where I was so, you know, how I related to him was so bonded. But in that bonded moment on the sidewalk, there was no clinging, no attachment. Is this distinction helpful? To me, it's very helpful because my attachment, my clinging to my child is something I can free myself of and become much more peaceful around my relationship to my child. But my bonding, my sense of responsibility and connection and empathy that comes from that, seems to me as something that is inherent in the relationship. And that has a whole life of its own that is still a little bit of a mystery to me and I don't quite understand. And I also don't quite understand where the difference is between the two. There's a gray area sometimes that I don't quite understand. Sometimes it's very clear that I'm clinging. Sometimes it's very clear that it's more a bonded kind of thing. But sometimes there's a gray area. And that's, you know, the area for me to study as part of the mindfulness practice. That makes some sense to you?
Not yet.
Not yet? Well, as I said, I don't know what I'm talking about. In 12 years, I might have some understanding of this process. And some of you already raised children, so maybe you're more qualified to talk about this. Let me say a few more things here. The basic practice of mindfulness is to notice what's happening in the present moment. When we sit down to meditate, we use the breathing as an anchor. Probably many of you have recognized when you sit down to meditate, there's a very strong tendency for the mind to wander off into thought, to be distracted. And to have an anchor is very helpful. Can we anchor the attention to the breathing? Can I commit the attention to the breathing? And that does a couple of things. On one hand, it develops stability and concentration. It kind of strengthens the concentration muscle. And the other thing it does is it tends to weaken the compulsive forces within us to be caught up in thoughts. There's a tremendous momentum within us sometimes to run off into our thoughts and think about them and engage in them and analyze them. And it's like a force. And as we, when we stop giving into that force becomes weaker, falls away, gives up or whatever, relaxes. So by anchoring ourselves to the breathing, coming back to the breathing as much as we can, staying with the breath, the compulsive force of distraction, distractibility, over time weakens. And one of the reasons why people relax in meditation is that they're no longer chasing after their thoughts. And often, chasing after thoughts is what makes people tense. So we use the breath as an anchor, stabilizer. At some point, something in our experience will become more compelling than our ability to stay with the breathing. Some strong bodily experience, some physical experience will arise. And then the instruction is let go of the breathing and take up this physical experience as the meditation practice. Whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, doesn't matter. And see if you can establish a mindfulness, a non-evaluative, allowing awareness of this physical thing that's going on. And an allowing awareness is really a key. The word allowing is very important here. Because many of us have this, we relate to what's happening all the time. We're for it, we're against it, we want it different, we want to keep hold on to it, we want it to make it better. We're always trying to, we're often trying to manipulate and change and do something with our experience. The allowing part of mindfulness is to give, is to rest all that and allow things to be as they are. So if a strong physical experience arises, just to learn to train yourself to learn how to rest with it, with that experience, to develop a meditative awareness on that physical sensation, as we talked about last week. When an emotion becomes predominant, when that becomes the strongest thing in your experience, more compelling than your breathing or your physical experience, then the emotion becomes the focus of the meditation. And we do emotion meditation. And that is, we recognize the emotion and try to see it as clearly as we can without any extra entanglement, judgment, evaluation, criticism, holding on, or anything to its presence. So as I said earlier, we want to give it its freedom, the emotion its freedom to be as it is. There's no need to censor it or feel that it's wrong or bad. You're welcome to have the most horrific emotions, feelings, or the most beatific, that's right, in meditation. What you're asked to do is not to censor it, not to resist it, but rather let it flow and at the same time see it clearly for what it is. And by seeing it clearly for what it is, find some way to be independent of it. So to do that with emotions, there's four different aspects of mindfulness of emotions, which I think are useful to talk about. The first is, it's very important to recognize the emotion as it's occurring. I've had very powerful emotions in my early years of practice, which I ignored because I just wasn't tuned into my emotions that much. And it was kind of like I had blinders on. And for me, a big part of this, my early practice, was learning simply to recognize when a strong emotion was happening, that I was having emotions. The second aspect is to accept it. This is the allowing part. Acceptance doesn't mean we condone it or justify its presence. Just means that we're not going to push it away or hold on to it or censor it or resist it. We're just going to allow it to be there in our experience as we meditate. The third aspect is to name it. Naming is a very helpful practice, to name our experience. In the ancient folk tales of many cultures, if you name the dragon or the monster, it loses its power. Or in some cultures, you weren't supposed to tell people your birth name. You had a nickname you told people. You didn't tell them your birth name because the understanding is that they would have some kind of power over you if they knew your name. By naming the emotion loses a certain kind of power. And the power that it loses is really the power we invest in it by our identifying with it. by our defining ourselves or getting involved or entangled with it. And if we're simply naming it, kind of matter-of-factly, and there it is, happy, happy, sad, 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 it kind of separates us a little bit from it, so we're not so invested or entangled in it, and we can see it more clearly. In my early practice, I saw this very clearly once when I was feeling kind of off, feeling not so, you know, kind of off. I didn't know quite how I was feeling, but I knew I felt kind of off and off, so out of sorts. I went back to my room and lay down, and since I was a practitioner of mindfulness, I started paying attention to that. I didn't turn on the television or take a shower or do something to kind of pull myself out of it or ignore it. I said, okay, I'm going to be here with it and really feel it. And I could feel tension in my chest. And I felt that every time I exhaled, my breathing didn't relax all the way. It's like I couldn't really exhale completely. It's like my chest was extended out. So I hung out with that, just felt that in my body, getting to know it better, exploring it, feeling it. And then at some point I recognized that what I was feeling was I was depressed. And I named it. I said, I'm depressed, depressed. And as soon as I named it, the chest relaxed, released. So that was one very quick, happy story. It often isn't that quick. But the naming of it sometimes helps us not to identify so strongly with it. And it often is identification which is the fuel that keeps it going. I remember there was I read a number of different clinical studies of people who use mindfulness in kind of psychotherapeutic kind of settings, where they people who have very severe psychological difficulties are told to name what they're doing while they're doing it. And it seems to help tremendously in keeping them in the present. And by keeping them in the present, their mind is less available to fantasize and wander off and cause problems. An idle mind causes a lot of problems. So this morning at 12 o'clock when I found myself not falling asleep, if I hadn't been mindful of what was going on for me, my mind would have taken over and I would have gotten probably quite upset and discouraged and afraid because of all the thoughts my mind was making about the meaning, what the consequences I thought were going to be about not getting enough sleep. But if I just stayed in the present moment, stay and stay and stay, then that mind's tendency to kind of fantasize and get caught up in interpretation is lessened to some degree. So naming is very helpful. Then the fourth aspect, so recognition, acceptance, naming, and the fourth thing is to investigate the emotion. And this is really one of the most interesting things you can do in practice, is to begin investigating more carefully, getting to know it better, what's actually going on. So what is a particular emotion? What does it feel like? What is it? Where in the body do you feel it? What's your relationship to it when it arises? In particular, it's very helpful to feel the emotion physically, the felt sense of the emotion. Where in your body is that emotion manifested? Almost all emotions show themselves someplace in the body. Where is that? Anger could be in the stomach, fear in the shoulders, tension in the jaw, different places in your body. And then to bring your attention very carefully and hang out there in that part of your body. Simply hang out in the tense shoulders or in the tight stomach. Hang out and hang out and hang out for as long as that thing is predominant and see what happens as a result. Continuing to ask yourself periodically, how are you relating to this experience? How are you relating to this tense in your stomach? How are you relating to it? To investigate and explore. And there's all kinds of interesting exercises you can do to help you with investigation, especially in daily life. One of them that I like, I call riding out an emotion, riding out the desire, for example. Some of us are compelled to act in certain ways or to do certain things when certain emotions are present. For example, a desire. Desires can be very compelling. I have to have it right now. But do the exercise of, if you have some kind of regular emotion that gets very strong for you and tends to overpower you or try to causes you to do certain things, when it begins happening, do your absolute best not to give into it, not to follow through. Like if there's a desire, for example, don't go out and buy what your desire says you to do, or don't say what the desire says you should say. But write it out. Hang out with it. Don't give into it. Don't act on it, but just kind of be still and composed and write it out. It can be, sometimes it can be very dramatic. It's like being on the rodeo because it's so strong. But write it out and feel really precisely, as best you can, what happens if you write out an emotion. And see if you can see it through all the way to the other side. If you have an emotion that you never see to the other side because you always act on it or run away from it or change it or fix it or do something about it, you're really shortchanging yourself. But if you hang out with it and see it to the other side, you might feel a tremendous confidence in your ability to remain free and independent of your emotions in the future. You no longer will feel that you're compelled to act in any kind of way because of the presence of how you're feeling. So the freedom from compulsion is a lot of what Buddhist practice is about. And the path to that is mindfulness and investigation. Does that make some sense? Do you follow that well enough? It's a whole different thing, of course, to put it into practice. So let's do another short sitting. And if you'd like to stand for a few seconds, just as you've been sitting for a long time, so, take a comfortable, alert posture and gently close your eyes. Some people think of meditation as a process of homecoming, coming home to oneself in the present moment, feeling at home in the present moment with the way things actually are. So taking a couple of long, deep breaths, and as you exhale, settle into your body, into your place here. Sometimes the thinking mind can feel like a muscle that's tense, exhausted. See if you can relax the thinking mind, soften it, and then settle your attention in the simplicity of breathing in and breathing out. when your mind is caught up in your thinking, relax the thinking mind and begin again with the breathing. What is it in your experience that needs to be accepted so that you can be more fully at home or present here and now? So, so now there's three aspects to the mindfulness practice that I've taught so far. Anchoring yourself in the breathing. And then, if they're compelling, predominant, bringing your meditative awareness to your physical body. And then today, if they're compelling or predominant, bring your attention to your emotions, your meditative awareness, your accepting awareness of what's happening emotionally. As you do this as a meditation practice, those of you who are relatively new to this, continue with 20 minutes of meditation a day, incorporating these three aspects of the meditation. And what you might also do is, in the course of your daily life, begin looking a little bit more, in a new way perhaps, on your emotions, how they work for you, and in particular, what your relationship is to your emotions. When certain emotions arise, how do you relate to them? Do you believe them, or how do you get caught by them, or how do they shape or influence how you see the world or see other people? How do you relate to them? How do you relate to the presence of an emotion? And while you do all this, have a good time doing it. It's really fun. It's really can be really interesting and an enjoyable process. So I wish you all a happy week, and see you next week. Thank you.